and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. Today I speak with Mark Santiago, who's written a book about the a war between Spain and the Mescalero Apache from 1795 to 1799. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Mark Santiago, author of A Bad Peace and a Good War, Spain and the Mescalero Apache Uprising of 1795 to 1799. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
So first, tell me how you got into studying and writing about history.
Well, I've always been interested in history since I was a young child, and I received a bachelor's and master's degree in history from the University of Arizona, and then I've had a career in museums, in history museums. I worked at the Arizona Historical Society for about 16 years, and I have also worked now for the Department of Cultural Affairs of the state of New Mexico, and been director of two museums, and I'm currently the director of the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I've been here for about 12 years now. So history's always been sort of my vocation and also my hobby. You know, my day job is working in a history museum, but I've also been very much interested in general history, Western history, and military history. And I've written about four books and about over a dozen articles and book chapters and monographs, mostly dealing with Spanish military history, Spanish colonial military history in the Southwest.
Okay, so tell me then about this book.
It's called A Bad Peace and a Good War, and it deals with a sort of the culmination of about 30 years of Spanish attempts to deal with the Apaches in general, who turned out to be one of the most difficult peoples the Spanish encountered in the New World and in the Americas. The Spanish had struggled for actually over a couple hundred years on coming up with a policy to deal with the Apaches. They really didn't start to formulate that policy until the 1760s, after Spain had suffered a rather humiliating defeat by Great Britain in the Seven Years' War. The Spanish began to institute what was called the Bourbon Reforms, which was basically designed because they knew there would be another war against Great Britain for colonial dominance in the Americas. And so under King Carlos III, King Charles III of Spain, there was this great series of attempts to reform the bureaucracy and the military. And as part of that, along the northern edge of Spain's empire, what was called the interior provinces of New Spain, which is essentially the northern edge of Mexico, what's now the Republic of Mexico, and the southwestern borderlands of the United States, basically stretching from the Sea of Cortez to the Gulf of Mexico, was along the borderland frontier. The Spanish attempted to get the most bang for their bucks by reforming this area as sort of an early warning system against any possible European intrusions from the French or the British and later the Americans. But in this area, the Spanish found that there were numerous Indian people that they could confront, and the most troublesome from their point of view were the Apaches. And the Apaches basically engaged in an on-again, off-again series of war with the Spaniards that escalated after the Spanish attempted to militarize that northern frontier. And this particular book, A Bad Peace and a Good War, deals with sort of a period that many historians had said was one of relative peace, where the Spanish had appeared, at least initially, to have sort of subdued the Apaches and to place them onto a reservation type of system. But then in the midst of this, in 1795, there's a very large upscale and violence that basically could be characterized as a war between one particular Apache group of people known as Mescaleros and the Spaniards. And this book chronicles the course of that war, what caused it, how the Spanish won it, and very terrible consequences the war had for the Mescalero people. And in a great irony, all this, while the Spanish are essentially winning this war and firmly establishing themselves in the borderlands region, in the interior provinces, this is happening at a time, almost exactly the same time, that Spain's empire, the seeds for its own destruction, are being sown as a result of the revolutionary wars in France and the rise of Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, the growth of the United States as an independent power that would see the true threat to Spain's northern empire emerging. So basically, at the time the Spanish are defeating the what they thought was their primary purpose, the Mescalero Apaches, they're being confronted with European and American politics and military incursions that will lead to Spain's destruction of her empire.
So I have a question from the Mescalero point of view. If I'm if it's correct, I read that in the early 18th century, some of the Mescalero had been driven from their homeland by the Comanches to where they ended up. Did you get the sense that they were sort of at the final, you know, they weren't going to move again? Or, you know, what was their resistance to Spain about?
Well, it very much is that. All of, you know, the Spanish identify a very large group of Apaches, and first of all, they're, in the 18th century, there is no sense of nationhood among the Apache peoples. The Apaches are broken up into various and sundry bands and groups, ranging from what would now be central Arizona through almost all of New Mexico, and all the way through West Texas, as far as almost to the environs of San Antonio, Texas, and then the entire basin of the Rio Grande Valley. So basically, most of the American Southwest and most, or a large portion of the Mexican states of Sonora and what's now Chihuahua, Nuevo León, Nuevo Santander, Coahuila, very large area. And in this area are perhaps 20,000 people identified as ethnic Apaches. They are broken up into at least 8 or 10 major groupings. The peoples to the farther to the west live in a sort of a desert mountain environment, and then the people moving, including the Mescaleros and their kinsmen, the Lipan Apaches, ranging from essentially central New Mexico into Texas, live in a different biological zone, one that has both mountains and deserts in it, but one that also has the Great Plains, the so-called Llano Estacado, the palisaded plains of Texas and New Mexico, an area where the buffalo are dominant. Up until about the 1730s, the Apaches, the Eastern Apaches of Lipan and Mescaleros and the Jicarilla Apaches dominate that whole area. And control the buffalo, essentially. Beginning about 1700 to about 1740, the Comanches then emerge from the Rocky Mountains and push into this area. And very quickly, because there are many Comanches, they're very numerous, and they are very aggressive, they begin to war with the Apaches, and to push the Apaches out of the south, out of the Buffalo Plains. The Mescaleros are one of the peoples that suffer this greatest push by the Comanches. So from around 1720, 1730, 1740, the Comanches are pushing the Apaches southward. At the same time, this is almost the exact same time, we talked about a little bit earlier, the Spanish reforms are beginning about 1750, 60, 70, and the Spanish are formalizing and controlling their portion of the frontier, their northern frontier. And so what's happening is, as the Spanish are militarizing their borders, their northern borders, the Comanches are pushing the Apaches southward, basically up against this Spanish, new Spanish military frontier. And the result is that the Mescaleros and other Apaches are beginning to be squeezed in between two great powers, the Comanche and the Spaniards. And this is, of course, the reason for the violence. And as this book details, this occurs over several decades, and the Spanish attempt initially to crush the Apaches militarily by establishing a line of presidios, a line of forts, presidios is a fort or garrison, along the northern borders, and to militarize this area, they begin to send out punitive expeditions, etc., to keep the Apaches from raiding. Because a great consequence of this being caught in a vice by the Apaches is that their traditional proclivity for raiding, for horses and other things, increases. They find that they can no longer grow food, they can no longer, because many of them were semi-agriculturalists or pastoralists. Others, are being confronted by the Comanches and they don't have the ability to hunt freely, the buffalo on the plains like they used to. So they raid Spanish settlements or Hispanic settlements, Hispanicized Indians within the Spanish zone of control, for food and for horses and for all of their needs. And of course this leads to an uptick in violence. And the Spanish, from about 1765 to about 1791, are engaged in a constant on-again, off-again series of battles with all of these Apache peoples. Initially, they concentrate almost exclusively on military expeditions, to sort of, seek and destroy expeditions into the Apache heartlands to attack them, to kill and capture and enslave and deport. And due to the nature of Apache society, which is very atomistic, the Spanish are never able to completely eliminate that Apache threat. Mm-hmm. Beginning in the about 1785 or so, theoretically under the leadership of a man named Bernardo de Galvez, who was became a viceroy of New Spain. New Spain includes all of what is now Mexico and the American Southwest. The Spanish go from essentially what had been a mailed fist policy into a bit more a mixed policy of the velvet glove. They begin to establish what are essentially reservations. Later historians will call these reservations establecimientos de paz in Spanish, which means a peace establishment. And essentially these are areas where the Apaches will be given a ration of food for their families, and expected to stay within an area around a Spanish presidio, around a Spanish fort, to receive their rations. And in exchange for that, they will stop raiding and become auxiliaries of the Spaniards. And very often they'll turn to raiding other Apaches in union with Spanish arms. Classic Roman and later Spanish policy of divide and conquer. And so by about 1791, there are 8 or 10 reservations scattered along the northern frontier. Some, for example, there's a reservation outside of what's now Tucson, Arizona. There's two large reservations outside of El Paso, Texas. There's one south of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And so there's this series of reservations the Spanish attempt to attract the Apaches to. This worked very well, and what the Spaniards do, realizing that the Apaches are not a unified people, that there are Lipans and what they call Lipayans in the east, there are Mescaleros in the middle, there are Chiricahua and Warm Spring, White Mountain Apaches in the west. The Spanish will use this to, for example, have Chiricahua Apaches help them fight Mescalero Apaches who are not near the reservation. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, they'll have Mescalero Apaches help them fight against Chiricahua or Lipan Apaches who are not near the reservation. So by about 1791, there's about 2,000 Apaches gathered around these Spanish presidios, Spanish reservations, and they're known as Apaches de Paz, a peaceful Apaches. There's probably, another 10 or 12,000 Apaches who are not near the reservations, who are still raiding, And so there's a clear break between those who are within the Spanish orbit and those who are, at least formally, and those who are not. The Mescalero Apaches are sort of in the middle, and they're kind of unique in that they have both a mountain desert environment that they live in and a plains environment. And so they have what's called a mixed economy, or what we call a mixed economy. They can plant and they can harvest native and introduced plants like corn and wheat in their mountain valleys, but they can also go into the plains and hunt buffalo. Their name is derived from their cultivation of the fruit of the agave plant, which in Spanish is called mezcal, and thus they're called mescaleros. The mescaleros, during this period of violence, they fight fairly well for a fairly long period of time, but large numbers of them begin to accept the Spanish offer, if you will, of the velvet glove, and settle near Spanish settlements, ranging essentially from what's now El Paso, Texas, down into the area where the modern city of Presidio, Texas is, across from Ojinaga, Chihuahua. It's an area of about 200 miles in width, and follows the Rio Grande farther up to an area south of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where it's a large swath. And that's the traditional Mescalero homeland. A lot of them are in these peaceful establishments. They're there beginning from the 1790, 91, 92. Things go fairly well for several years, and there's a general sense among the Spanish that they have pacified the northern frontier. However, in 1795, due to a lot of external circumstances, many emanating from European wars, the Spanish begin to cut back the financial underpinnings of many of their institutions on the northern frontier in order to send money, because Spain finds itself at war with revolutionary France between 1793 and 1795. And then later, Spain will switch sides and join France, later under Napoleon, against the British. So at this period, the Spanish European entanglements are causing a great strain empire-wide for finances and military resources. These are withdrawn from the Apache's de Paz program, and because of this cutback in rations, many of the mescaleros in this area basically say, why are we doing this? We're not getting what we need. And so they attempt to begin to turn to raiding again, basically an open war. And this is where the book essentially begins and explains the nature and the evolution of that conflict over about a four-year period.
So let me ask you about the demographics of this area at the time. One, was most of the population clustered around these presidios, or was there a lot of homesteading across the area? That's my first question. I'll let you answer that.
It depends on the area, and it depends on the presidio. The initial Spain's thrust along the northern frontier is not like a wave moving uniformly northward. There are long arms, if you will, little channels of Spanish population that they sort of thrust beyond the frontier. So, for example, the Spanish, although they claim most of Texas, they really only control an area along the Gulf Coast from what's essentially now Goliad north to San Antonio. And San Antonio is sort of the edge of that eastern Spanish control. In New Mexico, they control an area from around El Paso, which is at the time is, you know, even though it's now El Paso, Texas, was a part of the province of New Mexico. Then there's a great gap of a couple hundred miles until there's a cluster of settlements around Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Taos. Similarly, in areas Arizona, around the areas of what's now Tubac and the city of Tucson. And then similarly, there's a small, that's a very large and thin line that will eventually go up the California coast. So although Spain claims this area from California to Texas, she really only actually controls these four or five little fingers of land thrusting into what is now the American Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the Spanish attempt to militarize the frontier in the beginning of the 1760s, led initially by an Irish expatriate in the Spanish army, a guy by the name of Hugo O'Connor, and later by a Frenchman in French service, a gentleman by the name of Teodoro de Croix, the Caballero de Croix. The Spanish established a line of presidios, a line of forts, stretching from essentially the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico, and eventually be about somewhere between the neighborhood of 18 and 20, depending upon the time. And this line of forts parallels a line drawn on the map, essentially, a 30th north parallel, and the irregular course of the Rio Grande. And this is where the Spanish place most of their presidios. And the presidios are, for the most part, what, to use a modern anachronism, would be a forward operating base. Many of them are isolated. They're within, you know, maybe 100 miles of each other. But many of them are placed at strategic locations, fords of rivers, mountain passes, this type of thing. But they are designed, again, not to necessarily attract settlement, mm-hmm. but to get at this, you know, a modern anachronism of forward operating base, to project power into the area. The interesting thing about the line of presidios is that if you follow where the presidios are on a modern map, it is essentially the boundary between the United States and Mexico today, which is rather fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
That is really the area where that's south of that area, that's what Spain really controls, even though she claims these areas beyond. Some of the presidios, like Santa Fe in New Mexico, like Tucson in Arizona, like San Antonio in Texas, are what are called presidios beyond the line, okay? They're areas that have been settled before this line has been formed.
Mm-hmm.
So they are, in those areas, there will be not only the fort, but there will be the presidio itself, but there will be sometimes missions of the Catholic Church to gather other native peoples and a civil settlement. So, for example, in San Antonio, Texas, you have the Presidio of San Antonio, but you also have the villa or the town of San Fernando de Bejar, okay, which will later become San Antonio,
mm-hmm.
and you have four missions, five missions actually, including what's now the Alamo. And so you have, in those areas, you do have a cluster of settlements, a cluster of people not necessarily linked just to the military. The same thing will be true in, for example, in Tucson. Tucson, there'll be a presidio, but the presidio is very close to the Mission San Javier del Bac, which is, and there is an Indian settlement, a Pima Indian settlement, and so a town will grow up around the presidio. Others are very isolated. Others are in the middle of nowhere, and there's nothing. Several, you know, the presidios in the big bend of South Texas are there, and they're just kind of out in the middle of nowhere. They literally are just by themselves out there. So the demographics really depends upon the area. For the most part, most of the populated areas, with a few exceptions, are south of the Presidio line. So it very much is a military frontier, and like most military frontiers, it is, although there will be civilian settlements that will eventually grow up around the garrisons, not all of the Presidios turn into modern cities or modern towns. Does that answer the question?
Yes. So with the isolated Presidios that I guess are placed around choke points, how large a or how large a force would be at those?
The Presidios, the Spanish will, throughout the late 18th, early 19th century, will begin to expand. They start out as very, very small, beginning about, about 17... 1670, going to about the 1780s, most of these garrisons have a more or less standard component of about 50 men, including officers. And they're very, very small. And yet these men are required, you know, or theoretically are required to, you know, cover vast areas on sort of not only maintain their own horse herds, their own families, and, you know, the sort of general duties of any military post, but then to be able to repel any incursions into the area by Apaches or other hostile Indians, and time to time join together and launch punitive expeditions, you know, outside of it. So they try valiantly, but they fail valiantly. There's simply not enough of them. They're simply spread too thin.
Mm-hmm.
So they start out with a total garrison along, stretching from again, California to Texas, a garrison of less than 1,000 men. Well, you know, the British in a single fort in Lewisburg or one of these places, you know, will have five times that men in one fort.
Mm-hmm.
The Spanish are trying to control an area, essentially, you know, over, you know, I guess probably several thousand square miles with less than 1,000 men. Over time, the Spanish will begin to increase the number of forces, but it never really rises. By the time of the Mescalero Uprising in 1795, the highest level the Spanish will ever hit in terms of garrisoning this area is about 3,000 men. So it's still very, very small. Most of the presidios will have a garrison by the 1790s, ranging anywhere from about 75 men up to some of the more exposed ones will have a garrison of approximately 150 men. So by the standards of the day, they're very, very tiny places. And yet they do very well. The soldiers are very hardy. The soldiers are very, they're drawn from the country. They're magnificent horsemen. They're very good cavalry. They are, technically, they are, in 18th and 19th century terms, they would be, somewhere between what would be called a dragoon and a heavy lancer.
Hmm.
Theoretically, the soldiers are what are known as soldado de cuera, which means leather jacket soldiers. The cuera that they wear is a large vest, that covers from it's armor, essentially, covers them from the neck. It's sleeveless. It goes from the neck to the thighs. It opens at the front. And it's usually stitched together. Its regulation would have called for seven layers of deer or antelope hide, untanned, which is very flexible and which had a great ability to stop Indian arrows and even lance thrusts.
Hmm.
Each soldado is required to theoretically have a brace of pistols, a carbine, a sword, as well as a lance, a 9-foot lance. This style of fighting evolved from over centuries and initially had been designed to be a defensive individual, thus the armor. Maybe this will also have a small adarga, which is a heart-shaped shield or a bilobate-type leather shield.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got these guys on horseback, and they've got all this gear, not counting their you know, their water and their food and their supplies. So they are really, in Napoleonic terms, they would be considered heavy cavalry. Well, you've got these guys out there, and they're chasing mainly Apaches, but others, who are usually equipped with a bow and the lance, sometimes with leather armor as well, but much lighter equipped and able to function very much as light cavalry. And so the soldado de cuera have a hard time catching up with Apaches.
Yeah.
So what begins to happen is the Spanish begin to develop different types of soldiers that are stationed in the presidios. They will develop a light cavalry called Trupa Ligera, which means light troop. These troopers will lose the cuera, lose the armor, lose the lance and the shield, and will just be equipped with carbine and pistols, and they're still mounted. They will also begin to train their soldiers, even though because they're supposedly dragoons, they begin to train their soldiers to fight on foot, to dismount and fight on foot. A very similar evolution to what the Americans do on the Western frontier in the 19th century. Hmm. And as a matter of fact, it's sort of an interesting thing. Almost everything that the American military, the American cavalry, does in the 19th century, you can see the exact same thing happening in terms of combined of arms, style of arms, etc. The Spanish do the same things 100 years earlier, which is rather interesting. So the Spanish soldiers begin to train themselves to adapt to the environment of their enemy. And one of the things they also do is very interesting is they begin to recruit other native peoples and eventually even other Apaches to serve as the Spanish will call them auxiliaries. But in many senses, these are the guys who are actually doing a lot of the fighting, or at least doing a lot of the scouting and finding where the Apaches are and other Indians are. So the Spanish begin to turn the tide when they begin to recruit native peoples as well as essentially diversify their armament and tactics.
Okay. So let me ask you three quick questions before I turn towards the resources used. One, I'm curious if the isolated presidios had cannon for any reason. Number two, did the location of these presidios, were they an obstacle to the native people's warring parties at all, or could they just exploit the gaps, you know, sort of the terrain gaps to get around them? And number three, the Spanish that were there, had these soldiers lived in the area for generations, or were they, many of them just newly from Spain?
Okay. The first question, most of the presidios will be equipped with cannon, usually at least 2 to 4, and they're usually ranging anywhere from what they would be called field cannon in Europe. They would be ranging from about 3 pounders to 6 pounders. Many of the presidios were actually walled, either in a diamond-shaped form or a square, depending on the terrain. And there would usually be bastions at the corners of the presidio walls. And, it was very common that there would be a cannon in each of the bastions. The cannons were very rarely used. There's a few instances fairly large Apache attack on the fort in Tucson in the 1780s, and where the cannon is actually fired in the midst of the attack, and has great psychological effect. That, you know, sort of the Apache say, "Okay, that's it. They're going to use their cannon. They stop fighting." The cannons and the walls of the presidios themselves, which are almost essentially medieval in context, you know, would have no effect on a European or an American force that, you know, would attack them, were totally beyond the capability of any of the native peoples to deal with. Mm-hmm. A high wall defended by guys with muskets and a few cannon can and did at times, you know, for hundreds of Indians. They simply don't have neither the technical siege craft skills to assault and take a fortified post, nor very often the inclination to do so. So yes, they have cannons, and they're there, but they're very much a deterrent to actual assault on the presidio itself. They're very rarely used, in combat. The second question was, I'm sorry, is that the second part was?
If the presidios were located in good spots, or were the native warring parties able to just move around them through, you know, terrain that might be considered desolate, maybe the native people could just move through it with ease.
They could move through them almost at will. The presidios of the line were not envisioned as a sort of a Hadrian's Wall type of thing. It was not envisioned that you know, they would stop Apache aggression or other people aggressions, you know, from getting past them. The point of the presidios was essentially, again, using a modern acronym, they were forward operating bases. So they were designed to offer mutual support to each other, as well as to be able to project power into Apache or other Native people's homelands through a counterattack. The idea would be that, yes, they would send out patrols between each presidios. You know, the squads would move from one presidio back and forth and patrol the areas between the presidios. But again, they were about 40 leagues apart, about 100 miles apart, and so the Apaches could go and come as they will. What the presidios were looking for was signs of entry. They would look for trail signs, horses, movement of people, that kind of thing. And then they would either send out an expedition that would pursue that trail south to where greater concentrations of populations were and where the Apaches probably were going to raid, or they would lay ambushes and try to catch the Apaches as they returned after the raid. Okay? Mm. So, and then the third thing they would do is they would, if they could, they would follow the Apaches back to their encampments, to the Spaniards called the Apache settlements rancherias, and that's just an encampment, and they would try to locate the rancherias and attack them there. So, again, presidios are not seen, again, as a impermeable defensive barrier. They're basically, it's a zone in which they will be active patrols, seeking to track, and if they can, stop Apache raids. But more often than not, they either don't find them, and the Apaches are farther south raiding, or they'll try to catch them as they come back.
Hmm.
In terms of the soldiers, many of them were from the area. They were called, the sons of the country, that the Spaniards would call them. And although initially the Spanish have a very, very distinct racial hierarchy, and although theoretically most of the soldiers must be Spaniards, that term is very permeable along the northern frontier. So you have folks who will be locals and who may be of mixed heritage. They may be what the Spaniards would call mestizo. That would be a mixed Indian and Spanish parentage. Some are even Indians full-blooded. But if they're Hispanicized enough, they speak Spanish, they wear Spanish clothes, style of clothing, you know, they live in Spanish-style housing, they're considered quote-unquote Spaniards, regardless of their racial background. Farther to the south of the frontier, of the military zone, the racial categories and the racialization in Mexico is much more strictly defined. You know, Indians are not allowed to move into Spanish society. Blacks are not allowed to move into Spanish society. On the frontier, because they need men, they need soldiers, again, if there's a veneer of Spanish culture or civilization, regardless of your ancestry is black or brown or white, you can pretty much serve as a soldier. So many of these people are from the area, including the officer corps initially, and the officer corps is usually drawn, or initially was drawn, from the sort of landed aristocracy, the merchants, the hacendados, the owners of the haciendas, or the great ranches and farms. And so there would be, you know, there would be a provincial elite, and many of the officers would be drawn from that. And most of those people were white. They were what the Spaniards would call criollos. They were of European Spanish descent, but had been born in the Americas. As part of the great reform movement that leads to the line of presidios and this series of militarization of the northern frontier, the Spanish crown will begin to send over, beginning in the 1760s, large numbers of European regulars who will serve as NCOs and officers in the northern frontier. And this is seen not so much as a military move, but very much of a what we might call a social control move. The Spanish crown is seeking to assert its greater authority over the region, and even though many of these local aristocrats who serve as officers are very good Indian fighters, they very often will look for their own interests first rather than the interest of the province or the area that they're at. They'll make peace with Apaches on their own terms and shift Apaches over to the next Presidio down the road. Hey, attack that guy and his garrison, because I don't like him. You make a peace with me, and I'll let you go. So there's very much of this localism and favoritism that totally destroys any coordinated military activity along the northern frontier. To counteract this, the Spanish send in essentially a veritable wave of regulars. They will recruit Europeans from the Spanish regiments in Spain, men who are privates in the Spanish regiments will become NCOs along the northern frontier. They get promotion, and junior officers, second lieutenants, and those types of things will get an advance, but they'll become captains. And so the Spaniards send regulars, regular officers, and NCOs to take control of the northern frontier. Two major reasons that. One is to that these people will follow orders and they will not be, they will not favor local interests over the regional interests. They will follow orders and they will be able to conduct combined operations with each other to a much greater extent than the locals had been doing previously. The second part of that is that because they owe their promotion and advancement to the crown, they will be more loyal to the crown than the locals would be. So there's an attempt to not only sort of increase military efficiency, but also to increase loyalty by controlling the upper echelons of the military to ensure they're loyal to the crown. So the people that populate the presidios are very much of a mixed bag. By the 1780s and 90s, you tend to see mostly officers, especially senior officers, who have a regular European background and training, a sprinkling of local elites in the sort of middle to junior officer corps, a few what would we call white folks in the ranks, but most of the ranks being mixed blood folks. And you even have a couple of presidios that are drawn and are completely made up, except for their officers, of Indians. You have three presidios that are made up of Pima Indians, Oodham peoples of southern Arizona, and what are called Opata peoples in what's now Chihuahua and Sonora, Mexico. So you have three regular presidios manned exclusively by Indians. These Indians, especially Opata, are inveterate enemies of the Apaches, and so the Spanish will recruit them, train them, put them on the, you know, the regular list, the army list, which is, again, is unheard of. In the rest of Mexico, and indeed the rest of Spanish America, it's illegal for Indians to be armed. They're not allowed to carry weapons because the Indian population is so great. In central Mexico, the Spanish fear an insurrection, so they basically disarmed the local population. However, on the northern frontier, you had this really unique situation where you actually had three presidios, three forts of Indian soldiers. A situation that would be unheard of anywhere else in New Spain.
So let me turn towards the to the resources you used for your research. What did you use for this?
I was able to access a fair number of primary Spanish documents, essentially. The three largest repositories, two in Spain and one in Mexico City. There's the Archivo General de la Nación, AGN, it's often referred to or abbreviated. That's the Mexican National Archives, and they're housed in Mexico City. And then there are two large archives in Spain. The first is the Archivo General de las Indias, which is housed in Seville, Spain, and that's the English translation is the General Archives of the Indies, and this is a huge repository, and the Spanish refer to all of their overseas possessions, both in North and South America, in Africa, and in Asia. They refer to all their overseas possessions as the Indies. You know, Columbus went to find the Indies, and so they sort of kept that name. And so this repository has, basically, it's the colonial archives of the Spanish Empire. The third is our Cuba General de Simancas. Simancas is a small city near Valladolid, north northwest of Madrid. And it houses, the Simancas Archives houses the Spanish military archives. It holds basically the records of the Spanish army. Many of the documents in these archives relate to the interior provinces, relate to Spain's military in what's now the American Southwest. Many of them, especially the archives in Simancas, can be accessed online through a Spanish national website, an archives website. Many of the Mexican archives, the AGN, and the archives of the Indies copies are housed in American repositories. So, for example, the University of Texas at Austin has a huge collection, as does the University of California at Berkeley, and as does the University of Arizona at Tucson. So many of the original Spanish archives, there are copies of them in the continental United States, and I was able to basically use it all. I have been to Mexico and have been to Spain. I did not use the archives there. I was able to use their archives, either the online resources or the copies that exist in American universities.
Okay. What part of the research for this book was most enjoyable?
Oh, gosh. There's a large section. Most of this original material for this book, I'd say probably about 80% of it, came from the Simancas archives. And I was able to access most of that online, although there were a large number of copies also at the University of New Mexico Library in Albuquerque, and some at the University of Texas El Paso archives as well. And I should add, at the UTEP, it's called University of Texas El Paso, there's a large archives belonging to the archives of the Ciudad de Juarez, which is the original El Paso. El Paso, you know, is a twin city. There's El Paso, Texas, and there's Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, right across the Rio Grande. Mm-hmm. Well, the archives of Ciudad Juarez go back into the 17th century, and so they have a large repository there that is at the University of Texas, El Paso, that deals with a lot of the Mescalero and local El Paso region thing, where much of the events in this war took place. So it's interesting that I was able to use the El Paso archives, the Juarez archives, which gave very much of a local flavor, you know, the guys on the ground dealing with this uprising. The archives in Simancas in Spain contained the correspondence of the Spanish leader in this war, a guy by the name of Pedro de Nava. His title was the Commandant General of the Interior Provinces. And that archive contained much of Nava's correspondence and with his superiors in Spain, as well as his subordinates in the interior provinces. So the congruence of those two sort of gave very much of a tactical level to be drawn from the Juarez archives, and the strategic level could be drawn from the archives in Simancas surrounding the correspondence and reports of Pedro de Nava. So to me, it was very fun to, you know, see these sort of grand pronouncements at the strategic level, and then look at the Juarez archives and see how did it really work at the local level.
So yeah.
That was a lot of fun and very interesting.
What was the most surprising thing you found in this particular research?
I think the most surprising thing I found was how ruthlessly efficient the Spanish were able to do to act in a war that caught them totally by surprise, at a time where they were distracted by imperial entanglements between, you know, with Napoleon or the Americans, and there's all these other sort of, you know, great sweeping things. Nava is able to, with brutal efficiency, develop a series of strategies and tactics that although it takes about 3.5 years, 4 years to bring to full fruition, the efficiency that the Spanish were able to do in developing a combined arms tactic with an overall scorched earth forward invading strategy. Nava very quickly realizes from reports from his other officers, and there's one guy in particular, his name is Antonio Cordero, who has actually wrote a treatise on the Apache culture, and he knew them very well, and would turn out to be their most deadly enemy. And one of the things Cordero communicates to Nava is that the Mescaleros, you know, even though they're sedentary, they're moving, they're all over this vast area, they have an Achilles heel that the Spanish will quickly and ruthlessly exploit, which is that, again, remember I talked at the beginning, they have a mixed economy. They mm-hmm. Through most of the year, they will plant corn in mountain valleys and stuff, harvest native fruits. But twice a year, they'll go into the Great Plains, despite the Comanche threat, and harvest buffalo. They'll kill buffalo, and they'll pack it back to their homelands and into the mountains. And they'll live off that for the year. So they have these two hunting cycles, which is usually in autumn and spring. And what Nava and Cordero realize is that if they strike the Apaches right as they are going out or coming back from their semi-annual buffalo hunts, they can essentially destroy their commissariat. They can essentially starve these people into submission. And this is exactly what they do. They begin to send out from a variety of areas, from, you know, moving south from Santa Fe, New Mexico, toward the Mescalero home, moving north from El Paso and from Coahuila, moving east even from Texas, or moving west from Texas. They will begin to attack the Mescaleros everywhere and anywhere, but most especially, repeatedly, in the winter and fall times when they're most vulnerable, and where traditionally the Spanish had not attacked in the winter time. And so realizing this, and it basically happens after about 3.5 years of doing this, they basically crush the Mescaleros because the Mescaleros cannot feed themselves. So the result is they have to return to the peace establishments, that they had left early in the war. And basically submit. So even though it takes about 3 or 4 years, it's really it really shows that the power of a nation state can exert against a tribal society.
Was there issue or question that was particularly difficult to research and find an answer to, or maybe you still haven't found an answer to?
Well, the initial reason I started the research for this book was what started it. There was passing references in many secondary and including a couple of primary sources talking about how the Mescaleros at Presidio del Norte and El Paso rose up. There was an insurrection, and they killed approximately, 56 Spanish soldiers. And most of the references to this was like one or two lines, okay? And I realized, that's a lot of people to kill. You know, they've only got 3,000 troops out there, and that's a substantial chunk to lose in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. There has to be more to this story than that, because, losing 56 guys in one fell swoop would constitute one of the biggest defeats the Spanish had ever suffered in the 300 years that they had been in the Americas. They don't lose that many people, that, or at least that number, in one encounter. As I began to research this, I began to see that what many historians had said in the past was that, the period from beginning about 1790 until about 1820 was one of relative peace, along the northern frontier. Well, as I began to look into this, what had actually happened in this defeat, it became clear that it wasn't a single event, that it was actually two events, that they were about 3 days apart, wherein the groups of this group of Mescalero Apaches, essentially, you know, who had left the reservation, they were getting ready to raid into Mexico, essentially, through a series of accidents, either stumbled upon or were stumbled upon by these two contingents of Spanish soldiers. And the Mescaleros essentially didn't really want to fight, but they were sort of, you know, forced to. They sprang ambushes, and they more or less annihilated two groups of about 30 Spanish soldiers each. So the first thing I found was it wasn't a single event, it was two. And then as I began to find out, you know, well, the Spanish aren't just going to sit there and let this happen. There had to be consequences for this. Well, as I began to look at the events that came from the archives of Ciudad Juarez that talked about, one of the first things I came across was a very brief reference from the Juarez archives that a Spanish party had gone out and brought back the bodies of these 27 Spanish soldiers that were killed in one of these, first of these ambushes. Okay, so there's just a kind of passing reference. Then as you begin to look at it, you can see that these people in around El Paso and in Presidio del Norte are beginning to panic, and there's, my God, there's a big thing going on. At the same time, as I was looking through things in Simancas, I was trying to see, is there any relation to this? And I started looking at the dates and trying to look at the correspondence. And I began to see that, yes, there was, that Pedro de Nava and the sort of upper echelons of the Spanish, you know, react very quickly. And there was an entire range of material that began to discuss this war. And it went from 1795 to 1799. And although many historians have been aware of it, at least as far as I know, none had really made any hay out of it, as it were, okay? Mm-hmm. It wasn't that there was this long period of peace from 1790 to 1820. There's a substantial war, a very big war that covers, you know, almost the entire interior provinces, and it goes on for 4 years. And the Spanish are very concerned, and they you know, harnessed incredible amounts of energy and material and resources to do it. And there is also records of the Spanish reservation systems talking about various and sundry Apaches and how those Mescalero Apaches, how they reacted in the midst of this war. Mm-hmm. So one sort of led to the other, and what I thought would be a very small thing, frankly, you know, little acorn, a great oak sprang forth, and there's much more to this story than most historians had said, and it really modifies the standard historical historiography that, again, there was this uninterrupted era of relative peace in the late 18th and early 19th century, and this war was evidence of that, and it was really a very terrible war as far as the Mescaleros were concerned. The Mescaleros would end up losing approximately somewhere between 20% and 25% of their entire population, you know, which is an astounding number, if you put it in percentage-wise. And so, you know, you could really see many of the things that happened later on with the Americans and the Mexicans this period have their origins in this war and the concomitant results that it led to.
It sounds like this war was one of the first indications of the end of the Spanish Empire, you know.
It very much is. You know, it is, you know, in the 1790s, you know, under King Carlos IV, there's this great decline at the top, you know, the sort of the Spanish court is corrupt and venal, and under a guy by the name of Manuel de Godoy. And there's where Spain under Carlos III, who died in 1788, had really risen to be, you know, once again, a top contender with France and Britain, you know, for world domination, begins to decay under Charles IV, under Carlos IV, and, you know, he will eventually be, you know, overthrown by Napoleon and lead to the invasion of Spain, et cetera, and that causes the end of the Spanish Empire. That's when Bolivar and San Martin begin to, you know, lead the wars of independence after the invasion of Spain by Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
But the beginnings of this war, you can see it's very ironic. At the point that on the frontier at the almost the exact same time that the Spanish on the frontier finally get it right, finally get it to the point where, you know, all systems are go and hitting on all cylinders, at that exact same time, a world away, the seeds of the entire structure are sown with the beginnings of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, and Spain being sucked into a conflict that, that none of Europe really saw coming, and that really would, in the end, see Spain lose her empire, see all the great efforts she had made on the northern frontier evaporate in the wake of the wars of Mexican independence and Latin American independence. And the great tragedy of this is that the Spanish and the Apaches were really about a generation away from reaching a what probably may have been a long-term modus vivendi. The Apaches were becoming Hispanicized, at least the largest numbers of them were. They had reached more or less an accommodation with the Spanish in terms of Spain's power. They had curtailed their ratings. The Spanish were giving them, you know, the reservation systems were beginning to function well. And then when the system breaks down, and in the wake of the independence of Mexico from Spain, the system slowly shrivels and dies. And by the 1830s, the Apaches, all along the frontier, including the Mescaleros, revert to their old ways. They begin raiding actively again. And the great tragedy of this is within 10 or 15 years, when the Americans enter the area, they will have to repeat the process all over again. Exactly what the Spanish did in terms of the military policy of and the reservation systems, the Americans will have to go through the whole thing again with the Apaches again. And again, the Apache Wars will last. You know, they're the longest of the Indian Wars the Americans fight will last until the 1846 to 1886. And that's a great tragedy, you know, that if there had been perhaps a bit more stability in the late Spanish period, the Apaches' proclivities for violence and for raiding might have been, you know, controlled, and there might have been much less bloodshed after Mexico achieved her independence and after the Americans moved into the region. And the Mescaleros are interesting in that they are one of the few Apache peoples who actually were able to keep their own reservation in their, at least a part of their ancestral lands. Most of the other Apaches would be exiled to Oklahoma and other places like that, and they have a reservation in Fort Sill. But there's, other than San Carlos in Arizona and the Mescalero Apache reservation in New Mexico, most of the Apache peoples were driven from their land and never returned.
So you mentioned before that you want the book to sort of take a real look at this, what people considered an era of peace. Is there anything else you hope the book will do?
Well, I would like the book to show, and I try to show this in several ways. A lot of military history is fascinating because it deals with tactics and strategy and battles and how things are done, and you know, the sort of science behind that. And there is some of this in this book. You know, there is this sense of strategy and tactics. But, you know, war is unmitigated hell. And I was able to find in many of the aspects, especially regarding, sometimes with the Spanish, but more often with the Mescaleros, accounts that really brought home the sheer terror and horribleness of war. Not only in, you know, how people are killed in the course of violent battles, but also how there's this gnawing away of spirit and of physical resources. Again, the idea that the Mescaleros are basically defeated because they're starved to death. Even though they've still got their freedom, they're still able to run around there. There's a wonderful account, wonderful, it's actually terrible, of a Spanish attack on a Mescalero encampment in what would now be West Texas in the winter, and the Spanish drive through and they kill many of the Mescaleros, but the majority of the people, there's probably about 100 people in this rancheria, and probably about 75 of them are able to escape. But they leave, you know, they were caught at night, and they leave their lodges, their teepees, filled with their clothes, their food, their animals, their weapons, and the Spanish, you know, records, detail not only the course of the struggle, but they list all of these, all of the spoils that they took. And one of the things that's amazing is that they capture what they call 165 tercios. A tercio is a Spanish measure of weight that is a several hundred pounds. And when you convert that, the Spanish took the equivalent of several tons of buffalo meat from this one group of Apaches, and indicates that they had just finished their buffalo hunt. And that's enough food that would have fed them probably for 8 months. And they were getting ready to take the food back into the mountains and, you know, live the next year. Well, it's clear then that these people who were, you know, survived the attack, because the Spanish took and burned everything that's left, those people were condemned to a slow, starving death.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had lost everything. They had no weapons. They had clothes on their backs. They had lost their lodges. They had no horses, no tools, no weapons, no food. What happened to those people? There are instances in this book that are like that, that I hope people will appreciate the terrors of war, and that it's not just, you know, war is not just the killing of a person in the battle.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that affects people directly, you know, over long periods of time, more than we tend to think when we just focus on battles and strategy and tactics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you have any difficulties finishing or getting the book published? And if so, how did you overcome those?
I really didn't. I had published a couple, one book previously with the University of Oklahoma Press. And so I'd worked with them before. And so I had finished the manuscript and sent it to them, just asking them if they thought this was worthwhile. And you know, they sent it out to readers like they normally do. And very, very quickly they came back and said that they thought it was worthy of being published. And so I really did not have any issues in getting the University of Oklahoma Press to publish the book.
Okay, what's your next writing project?
Well. It's hard for me to say. You know, I continue to do research on Spanish colonial history and the military aspects of it. I would love to. I'm currently doing research on several of the garrisons, the presidios, and there's large numbers of service sheets for these soldiers. And I'm looking to see if there's any patterns and behavior and what they looked like and how their lives were, and basically fleshing out a little bit more, you know, of more personality, if you will, to some of these folks. And I hope to be able to put that together into a series of perhaps short essays that would fill a book, basically showing different aspects of life for these people, these Spanish soldiers and their families on the frontier.
I imagine your books will be available or are available on Amazon and on the press sites. Is there?
It should. I believe that the book will be out officially on October 20th.
Mm-hmm.
So not too far in the distance. Oh, 18th, excuse me. My wife's telling me that. You can already pre-order it on via the press. They've already begun advertising it, and you can pre-order it on their site.
Mm-hmm.
But officially, we'll be out on October 18th.
Do you have a social media presence or a website where people can follow what you're doing? Or
I do not have a social media presence. I don't. My wife is the editor for the Historical Society of New Mexico's magazine called La Cronica,
mm-hmm.
and she tends to put things out every now and then. So if people are trying to reach me or have questions, that's probably a better way to do it. I can give you. My wife has given me a email here that I could put that people are interested in, that I could answer questions.
Mm-hmm.
And people can also reach me through the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum, which has its own website, and I'm the director of the museum, so they can get a hold of me that way.
So, mm-hmm. So what's the? Did you want to say the email right now, or
if you'd like? Let's see. My wife just handed me a picture. It's M. Santiago, my name, M. Santiago, S-A-N-T-I-A-G-O, books at gmail.com.
Okay. M. Santiago books at gmail.com.
Right.
All right. Any final thoughts?
No, I do not. I very much appreciate your talking to me, and looking forward to hearing the podcast. I hope that people will find the subject matter interesting and perhaps lead them to explore. That's always the funnest part of history, is that people read something and then do their own research and begin to follow things. That's what I've always enjoyed the most out of history. So.
Cool. Well, thank you. This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H, C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.